Okay, thank you. I'll do my best. I think it's unfair for me to have to follow David Crow, because I would rather be up here telling you about my political beliefs and why everybody should follow them. But instead, I'm relegated to the Affordable Care Act, which I sort of adopted as a hobby when it came out, and I've been following it ever since. And there's a lot to tell you about just in the topic that I picked, so I'll do my best because we have about 30 minutes. Just as a brief introduction, you all know that the Affordable Care Act came out a number of years ago. It first was passed in 2010, began to be implemented in the years that followed, and there have been controversies. There have been parts of the act that have been small but now forgotten parts of the act that have been repealed. The act has been in court. Of course, it was held to be constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. There are parts of the act that are reviled by certain parties, and there are parts of the act that are championed because certain people think that the act is a pathway to what's known as a single-payer system, and that could be, that actually could happen. I think whenever we try to predict the demise of something, we have to remember that Columbus, in spite of the fact that he didn't have a compass and went the wrong way, still discovered America. And it could be that way with healthcare legislation in the United States. At least that's certainly the way it feels sometimes when I read about what's going on. So today, I'm just going to talk very briefly about a topic I call counting and moving, because that's what the statute has become. It's become counting. It's about becoming all about counting and all about moving. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. The counting part deals primarily, but not always, with whether or not you are what is known as a large employer and are therefore covered by many parts of the Act, or are a small employer and therefore the Act is irrelevant, at least for now. How do we count? Well, we count the number of employees, we count the number of hours that various employees work, we count the number of hours that seasonal employees work. We don't count volunteers and so forth, but all this counting is a great national scurrying for people to try to get out from under the umbrella of the Act. And why do I say a national scurrying? Because according to the sources that I read, the National Federation for Independent Business, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and so forth, 96% of the private employers in America, in other words, the employers who hire outside government, outside state agencies and so forth, are 50 or fewer employees. That means 96% of the private employers in America are concerned about the counting under the Affordable Care Act, which I think is a misnomer, but they call it ACA, which I call it, or also Obamacare. Because those are the numbers that the legislators picked when they passed the Act. So, just to recap very briefly, if you have 50 or more FTEs, which means full-time equivalents, then that means you're covered by the Act. If you don't have 50 or more FTEs, then you're not covered by the Act. If you're not covered by the Act, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about providing coverage. You don't have to worry about paying any penalties. You can tell all your employees to take a hike, and they're on their own, et cetera, and nobody will bother you. No penalties. Of course, you'll probably get some bad press and so forth, but some employers don't care about bad press. So it's very important to count up and see whether or not you've got enough FTEs to be covered by the Act. Another thing that's very basic that ought to be remembered about ACA is this. ACA does not require anybody, whether you have 10,000 employees or 10 employees, to buy health care coverage for employees. It doesn't. You are not required to do that. But if you have 50 FTEs, things can begin to happen to you based on ACA. If you don't provide health care coverage, and of course a lot more things can happen to you if you do, if you are an employer that has at least 50 employees and you don't have any coverage for them because either you've never provided it or you don't think it's needed or you have the kind of employees that get their coverage elsewhere, for example, from a spouse, so you don't have any health care coverage, and then you're floating along and one of your employees goes to what's known as a state-sponsored exchange. Now, there's a big litigation about this now, because the Obama administration would like to see federal exchanges included in this. Just as a little piece of history here, a number of people got very excited about Obamacare when it first came out, and it was predicted that almost every state in the union would adopt a state-sponsored exchange, which is a marketplace into which people would go to try to shop around for health insurance. As of now, only I think it's either 14 or 15 states have done it. The rest of the states say they're not going to do it, and several of the states that did set up these exchanges now want to get out of it because it's too complicated and too expensive for them to run. But at any rate, if you're this large employer, you've got all these employees, and one of them goes to a state-sponsored exchange and gets what's known as a premium credit, he comes back and shows you the premium credit, the government begins to assess you penalties. And the penalty is $2,000 per full-time employee. So that's a lot of money. So if you weren't spending, if you were spending zero before and suddenly it's $2,000 per employee, that can add up to a lot of change. So employers have begun to realize this. So they've begun to count, and count in many different ways. The main counting that you read about in the paper is there's an employer, a company that's on this pivot, and if he counts one way, he becomes a large employer. But if he counts another way and uses the formulas within ACA, he becomes a small employer, and so he's not bothered by the act. So it's counting, counting here, counting there. A lot of the newspaper stories that you read these days are about some great huge employer like Walmart, or some, I think Rite Aid did this too, or an airline, or a great big university. And you read that they just switched X number of employees, X thousands of employees, to part-time status. And some commentators have said, well, they're just trying to do that so that they can be classified as a small employee under Obamacare. Well, I don't care how clever you are. If you've got 10,000 employees, I don't care how many of them you convert to part-time status, there's no way in the world you'll ever be a small employer under ACA. The reason that these employees have been switched to part-time status and are counted as part-time because you count the number of hours they work, which is 30 or less, is because under ACA, you do not have to cover part-time employees. You don't have to do it. So, if you're an employer with 1,000 employees and suddenly 800 of them become part-time employees, you probably still are going to be covered under the large employer status under Obamacare, but you don't have to insure 800 of them. Now, I don't think you have to be a mathematician to figure out whether or not that's a good deal or it's going to save you money or how much money it's going to save you, but that's the fact is you will not be penalized for not covering your part-time employees. So the counting that's being done in that case is whether or not you got an employee who works 30 or less hours per week. That is the definition of part-time under Obamacare. So when you read about one of these enormous employers doing that, and they're not doing it because they want to try to get out of the penalties that will attach if they don't behave themselves as a large employer. They're just doing it because the math is there. So what happens to these part-time employees? Well, a lot of these part-time employees are the people that David Crowe was talking about earlier today. They're the young students who are living in somebody's basement, maybe yours. There are people who, if they're lucky, they're married to someone who already has coverage. Are there just people who, for the last 10 years or so, just cannot get out of this rut? They can't find a job that allows them to pull themselves up enough to get health care coverage because they just don't have that kind of a job. But the reality of the counting is this is what employers will do, especially corporations that, while they may look good in the press in terms of being enormous, if you look at their balance sheets, they're having a hell of a time making a profit or satisfying shareholders or whatever. And so suddenly, if they can save themselves $20 million, they're probably going to do it. So those are the kinds of counting that are taking place right at the moment, because it's all about dollars. You know, and corporations moving overseas and, you know, trying to get out of Obamacare, trying to get it repealed and so on and so forth. As far as the moving part goes, I said it's counting and moving. The moving part comes from the administration, this administration, because it keeps moving the goalposts. Okay, the goalposts in this case are the compliance deadlines. Okay, by when must a company comply with Obamacare? In other words, you know you're a large employer, you suspect you are. When do all these things begin to come into being? Well, when the statute first came out, it was 2014, everybody was going to be playing by the play or pay rules. In other words, you play, provide the health care coverage, or you pay the penalty. So the play or pay rules are what I just described. You're a large employer, depending on what you do, you either buy the coverage for your full-time employees or you pay a penalty. Well, then that got moved to 2015 because it was just too hot to happen in 2014. Too much of a change for people. And remember, the companies this is most likely to affect are the 96% of the private employers out there. So 2014 is gone, then it was 2015. As of February this year, it's now moved to 2016. Why? Well, because the next thing it was going to become effective on was January 2015. Well, how close is that to November 2014? It's real close. You know, people are going to be worried about that this time. It's like, well, I hate to make the analogy, but it's like the guy who's on death row. You know, if he's going to get executed next week, that's one thing. But if it's going to be 2 years from now, you know, at least there's some breathing room, that kind of thing. And also, the January 2015 date, as it turns out, I don't think that anybody really thought about this until it started happening, but this summer and this fall, a number of consumers across the country have received notices that they will not have the same health care coverage that they had before. Why? Because companies are beginning to position themselves finally and once and for all for the qualified plans that are demanded under the Affordable Care Act. You cannot just give your employees coverage. You have to give them coverage that's qualified under the Obamacare. And whereas there was a lot of press about grandfathered plans when the act first came into being, this is this whole business. You can, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Well, that practically none of that's true. For most plans, if you like it, you can't keep it. That's why it's being canceled, because it cannot meet the definitions and the inclusion benefits under the statute. So all that's happening right now, and again, I don't think that was planned to happen in the months leading up to the midterm elections, but that sure is what's happening. And I do think that will affect, A, whether or not people go to the polls, and B, how they're going to vote. But at any rate, and another moving action that's taken place since the inception of, since the enactment of Obamacare is this whole business of issuing administrative orders that change the law. For example, does the Secretary of Health and Human Services, did she really have the authority to issue all those waivers? I don't know. Did Obama really, his administration really have the authority to move the goalposts from 2014 to 15 to 16? No one knows, because no court has ruled on that. However, if you're the President of the United States and you have an Attorney General and you both tell all of your people, don't enforce this part of the law, or don't prosecute or penalize people who don't obey this part of the law, A, that's probably what's going to happen, and B, no one's going to complain, because who's going to complain if they don't have to pay penalties this year? Maybe they'll have to pay them next year. Okay, but as far as authority goes for all this moving around, I don't know. It's a question of debate in the legal community. You know, the presidents have done this before. They have, but not just within our memory. I mean, in our memory, when presidents try to be this high-handed, there's usually some consequence. You know, there's usually a Congress, congressional uproar, a Supreme Court case or something. Here, nothing. So, anyway. So the trends are right now, if you're in this pivot position where you could be small, you could be large, the trend is to try to do all the counting you can to stay small. The increase of the part-time workers, again, doesn't have anything to do with the large or small employers, but it has a great deal to do with the millions of dollars you're going to save if you switch everybody to part-time. The Another difficult problem with the counting aspect of all of this is what is known as seasonal employees, and I know that that is relevant to a number of players in the agricultural industries, including mulch and soil. How do I count my seasonal employees, and what's going to happen to me if I don't do it correctly? Well, the Affordable Care Act did recognize seasonal employees, although it should have done a better job recognizing that there are many industries out there, like the restaurant industry, for example, where one formula is just not going to fit everybody, but they at least tried to deal with the seasonal employee problem. What is a seasonal employee? It's someone, and I'm not making this up, for right now, what you have to assume is that if you're doing your calculation and you have seasonal employees, a seasonal employee is someone who works during the season, okay? A season. What is the season? Well, for right now, under the temporary regs, it's whatever you, in good faith, can convince the auditor, wherever it is, comes in and looks at all this stuff, that a seasonal employee is, okay? And that's just, you know, the character of the person. So if you've got somebody out there chopping down trees or driving a truck or operating some machine or something like that, and he only does it 120 days or less in a year, that guy's, for right now, that guy's a seasonal employee. That's what he is. Okay, why is this important? Because if you figure things right,
pardon me,
you don't have to include seasonal employees in the calculation as to whether or not you're a large employer or a small employer. You can just get rid of them. If the stars line up right, you can get rid of the seasonal employees. Now, if you have a lot of seasonal employees and you find out that they're working 200 days a year or 154 days a year, that is a problem, especially if you've got a lot of seasonal employees and they're all doing that. Okay, but you should really take a close look at your numbers. By the way, what I tell people, because every year we get more and more of these companies coming to us to ask us to sort of guide them through all this, you needn't do this at home. This is not the kind of work that you can just sit down at the kitchen table and do many times. What you can do, there are many, many healthcare brokers out there, and I've talked to a number of them, who are experts at doing this and who are experts at calculating all of this and can come up with a good result. Of course, they hope that you will also buy their policies that they're pushing, but you don't have to do this by yourself. You can hire a perfectly good healthcare broker to sit down with you and figure out a way to give a very realistic assessment of what it is you're looking at in terms of full-time equivalents. If you're on that teetering pivot, and you want to be a small employer, and you're just two employees this way or two employees that way, chances are, by including or excluding seasonal employees from the mix, you can get to the small-time employer. Why do I say that? Well, because there are a number of what are known as look-back rules for seasonal employees. You can look back, and right now, these are just the temporary regs, but for right at the moment, the government is very generous for how you figure out whether somebody's worked 120 days in a year. In fact, for the year 2014 that we're in right now, the look-back period is 2013, and you can pick any block of time you want, literally, to try to sandwich in, you know, how many employees did, how many days, and so forth. You can patch together any number of 120 days as you see fit. The 120 days don't have to be consecutive. So you can divide them up, parcel them out, and so forth, and before you know it, the seasonal employees are off the table. Now, I'm oversimplifying things, and I don't mean to be tongue-in-cheek, but it's the kind of thing that's so complicated that it is better if you have somebody help you do it. There has been a bill that's been introduced in Congress in August. It's called the... Well, before I go into the bill, let me just read you the definition of a seasonal employee from the Act. This is actually statutory language from the Affordable Care Act. If an employer's workforce exceeds 50 full-time employees for 120 days or fewer during a calendar year, and the employees in excess of 50 who were employed during that period of no more than 120 days were seasonal employees, then the employer is not a large employer under ACA, okay? That and the regs that go with it and so forth and all these look-back periods are the reason this can be a very complicated thing. But basically what that statutory ease, which I just read to you, means is if an employer's workforce exceeds 50 FTEs, full-time equivalents, for 120 days or less, it's 120 days or backwards, then the employer can remove the seasonal employees from the formula in determining if they're a large employer. Okay, that's basically what it means. It's a way of counting to get rid of the seasonal employees, because if you don't have to worry about the seasonal employees and you're on this teetering brink, it can make a big difference. The statute that's been introduced, it's a bill. It's called the Simplifying Technical Aspects Regarding Seasonality Act, or STARS, and the reason they call it that is so they can call it STARS for short. And it does clarify these definitions, so it amends ACA. And it's the reason people have hope for it is because it is does have a lot of bipartisan support. It's introduced by both Republicans and Democrats. Now, depending on how the election goes will depend on whether or not Obama will sign it, because he may well veto it if he feels that it weakens the fiber, if you will, of ACA, because there's been a lot of weakening because of all this number counting and so forth, and because the statute was not well put together, and I don't think people realized when it first came out that you can play with it, but for example, by switching a lot of your employees to part-time and so forth, so you can save money there and, you know, all that sort of thing. Or he might sign it because he feels that it will be a way of strengthening his stature, you know, that he's trying to work with people and all that kind of stuff. But also, you should note that the STARS of that bill is just one of dozens, and it may now be hundreds of bills that have been introduced since 2010 to try to remedy some of what's going on with Obamacare. The most potentially devastating part of Obamacare right now is not the counting so much as the definitional part. There's a definition in the statute that says for this. There are two different kinds of penalties under the statute. There's the kind I just mentioned that's $2,000 per employee, but there's a $3,000 per employee per full-time employee. Also, if certain facts occur, if you're an employer and you've got a health care plan for all your full-time employees and one of them goes to a health care exchange, one of these state-sponsored health care exchanges, he gets a premium credit because he says your health care plan isn't good enough. Why isn't it good enough? Because he's spending more than 9.5% of his adjusted gross income on health care premiums. If that happens, and then you get these penalties, which even though they're $3,000 per full-time employee, are actually less in many cases, because they will only apply to the people who are in the 9.5% poverty range. In other words, if you're spending more than 9.5% of your money on health care. Well, the reason is there's a case in the D.C. Circuit right now, it's about to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, I'm pretty sure, is because the statute reads quite clearly that the type of exchange you have to go to for that to happen is a state-sponsored exchange. Well, as I said at the beginning of the talk, not very many states ended up establishing exchanges. The federal government had to go into certain states and establish exchanges. So, if you're this kind of, if you're the 9.5% person and you go to a federal exchange and get your premium credit, do the penalties apply? No. Well, it's certainly arguable that they don't, because you can get them from a state sponsor. You can get the premium credit from a state-sponsored exchange. You got it from a federally sponsored exchange. So, I mean, there's a lot of very loud debate right now as to whether or not the statute really means what it says. It says state exchange, and a lot of congressmen and a lot of Democrats want to say, no, it means all exchanges, not just the state exchanges. But see, that's the kind of parsing and the pivoting and everything that goes into this, because it was a statute that was just rammed through. It's a statute that affects an enormous part of the economy, but it was rammed through without a great deal of thought. Most people hadn't even read the bill, and on top of that, it was not drafted very well. So probably all this fun is going to continue to go on for a number of years. And I suspect it probably won't get solved until there's a Republican Congress who probably won't repeal it. But what they'll probably do is take parts of it that are very objectionable, like the difficulty in discerning the formulas and accounting and so forth, and they'll get rid of that and keep some of the better parts, like the qualified plans part is really not that bad, because it does have things that all insurance policies ought to have. It's much more inclusive, and you can't throw people out for pre-existing conditions and so forth. I mean, there are things like that that people won't disagree with, but what they will disagree with is all this number counting and plotting and doing everything you can think of to make sure that you're not covered by the Health Care Act. And as I say, it's relevant to 96% of the private employers that are out there. Okay, so that's like a 20-minute speech on something that, you know, is massive and is going to affect everybody within the next year, because everybody's going to spend 2015 trying to get ready for all this. So I guess with that, I'll open it up to questions. If I can answer them again, I would like to qualify this by saying I do keep up with the Act, but there are entire portions of the Act and there are entire subsets of people's legal practice and accounting practice at this point that I don't know anything about. But I try to concentrate on the major parts. So, in the way back, yeah.
The 120 days,
yeah.
Is that calendar days? Is it work days?
Work days.
Monday through Friday.
No. It's days worked. So if they worked on Saturday and Sunday, you've got to count those, even though it's a weekend. Okay. Yeah.
What if you have separate companies?
No, it won't work. Okay.
I'm saying is, if you have a trucking company that trucks and you have a manufacturing company.
If they can find any commonality thread of ownership, then it's one company. Okay. It's been thought of. Also, I was going to say, if that's what you were asking.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And it doesn't make any difference whether they're different kinds of companies. They can be an LLC, they can be a C corporation, they can be a partnership. If they find this commonality of ownership, it's one company as far as they're, by they, I mean the government. Also, I should mention, when I give this talk, I also talk about Forbes magazine, for example, came out with this article that if you're on this teetering edge, one of the things you might consider, you could look through your workforce very carefully and see if there's any possibility that A, you already have independent contractors on board, or B, you've got people who could be turned into independent contractors. However, that is an extremely risky thing to do. I mean, if you thought it out, it's not risky. However, this independent contractor business is defined not just by one government agency. It's defined by the federal government, the IRS, the Department of Labor, and all the state agencies. The State Department of Taxation, that state workers' comp board, often have conflicting views of what's a workers' comp, and they have their own little list of criteria. There has not been a good Supreme Court case in the tax arena of what is an independent contractor. There's been a very good one in the copyright law arena, which no one pays any attention to. But you can. But if you look through your list of workers, and it's clear that three or four of them could be independent contractors because they're doing work for a lot of other people besides you. They pick their own hours, they have their own equipment, all that sort of thing. That's a way that you can consider getting under the 50-person FTE rule. Anybody? Well, now that I've thoroughly depressed you, we'll get ready for the cocktail party, right?
No.
Okay.
Thank you, John.